Chapter 4. Why Done It? Detectives, Deception, and the Dark Side. Warning: this chapter contains spoilers for the following books. Memory Man by David Baldacci. In the Woods by Tana French. And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. Agatha Christie once wrote, "Very few of us are what we seem. Appearances can be deceiving. Truth can be slippery. Secrets are inevitable." This is why in almost any bookstore, you'll find an entire section dedicated to a type of book we call the mystery. We turn to stories to find out more about ourselves, and we turn to mysteries to find out more about the dark side of ourselves. What evils lurk inside human hearts? What sins are we as a species capable of committing? And most important, why? If we look closely at what makes good mysteries so compulsively readable, it's not the who, but the why. It's the reason behind the crime, more than the criminal, that captures our interest and keeps us turning pages. In Agatha Christie's classic, And Then There Were None, although we're dying to find out which of the 10 guests on Soldier Island is killing people, it's the motive behind these deaths, the theme of judgment, that really fuels the story and resonates with us. In The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, the organization responsible for Jacques Saunier's death is not as interesting as the reason he was killed and the secret he was killed for. It's the why, not the who. Why would someone commit such atrocities? And what does that say about who we are as humans? Those are the two questions at the heart of the Save the Cat story genre called the Why Done It. Whether you're writing a classic murder mystery like an Agatha Christie, a detective mystery like the Harry Bosch series by Michael Connelly, or the Dublin Murder Squad series by Tana French, a political mystery like the Camel Club series by David Baldacci, or the Jack Ryan series by Tom Clancy, or an amateur sleuth mystery like The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, or In a Dark, Dark Wood by Ruth Ware, all Why Done It's share a common core. They all center around a crime that has been committed and a dark secret that lies at the heart of it. And it's your job as the writer to keep the reader guessing at every turn. Because regardless of whether your Why Done It detective is an amateur who's never solved a mystery or a private eye who's seen it all, in the end, the reader is your true gumshoe. It's the reader you have to wow with each shocking turn of the cards. Clues and reveals set to detonate like bombs at just the right moment, stopping the story in its tracks and sending the mystery in a new direction. And it's the reader who must be forever changed by what you ultimately reveal about human nature. Every Why Done It is like a series of increasingly dark rooms that we readers must walk through. We're not sure what we'll find at the end, or who, but we're along for the ride because we know it's going to answer the fundamental question behind every good mystery. Why? If you think your novel fits into the Why Done It category, you'll need three key ingredients to ensure its success. One, a detective. Two, a secret. And three, a dark turn. Let's take a look at each of these ingredients in more detail. The detective of your story can truly be anyone. It can be someone who's seen 1,000 dead bodies, or someone who's never seen a single one. But two things must be true of this person. They must be wholly unprepared for what they're getting into, regardless of their job and/or experience. And they must have a reason for being dragged into this mess. Again, why this hero for this plot? The connection can seem random at first, but if you don't marry your hero to your plot, or your detective to your mystery in this case. Your reader will leave the novel saying those dreaded words. Yeah, so? Think about Amos Decker, the detective hero of the whydunit novel Memory Man by David Baldacci. At first, the murder of his entire family, which starts off the story, seems completely unrelated to the school shooting that happens over a year later. But ballistic evidence soon reveals that it's the same perpetrator behind both crimes, making Amos much more important in the investigation. Or think of how shocked the Da Vinci Code's Robert Langdon is when he's brought into the Louvre in the middle of the night and finds a dead man lying naked on the floor, next to a cryptic message written with the man's own blood. It's not your everyday occurrence for a symbologist. But as Langdon soon learns, the part of the message that was erased by police included his name. He's definitely involved. But why? Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None has an interesting twist on the detective ingredient. Although all the guests on Soldier Island are desperately trying to figure out who the murderer is before they become the next victim, the true detective in the story is the reader. True, we are always the ultimate detective of every whydunit, but in this case, we are the only one. What all detectives have in common, however, is that they are not prepared for this case, regardless of how many cases they've solved before. Because if this case, in this novel, doesn't show them something they've never seen before, then what's the point? If the secret that is ultimately unveiled is something your hero or detective has dealt with before, then what's the mystery? Which brings us to our second ingredient. As the detective unravels the clues, and you, the author, continue to turn over the cards, the secret is finally revealed. This secret is why we search for the truth to begin with. It's the heart of the whydunit. It's what we find in the last dark room. It's not just the who and the why. It's the what, where, and when, too. It's what keeps the reader guessing until the very end. The bait that pulls us through the entire story. Because we, and the detective, need to know. We need to find out what really happened to Harriet Wanger in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. We need to discover what the Priory of Sion is hiding in the Da Vinci Code. We need to find out what happened to Jessica in that wood in the Woods by Tana French. And you, the author, need to make sure the secret is a good one. The secret often starts out small, but grows as the detective digs deeper into the case and uncovers more clues. In Memory Man, we first learn that the same gun was fired at both the murder of Decker's family and the recent school shooting. But as author Baldacci continues his skillful turning of the cards, the secret grows, and we soon discover that the murderer is actually targeting Decker specifically and trying to send him a message through both homicides. In And Then There Were None, one death turns to three deaths, turns to seven deaths. The plot and the secret thickens with each dead body that turns up. But as the secret grows deeper, so does the detective's desire to solve the case, which leads to their dark turn, the third ingredient of a whydunit. The dark turn is the moment when the hero breaks or abandons the rules, either their own or society's, in pursuit of the secret or the truth. Like when Amos Decker in Memory Man heads off on his own to confront the killer by himself in the third act, without backup and without sharing his latest breakthrough with the other agents working the case. A huge violation of police investigation rules. The rules broken can be moral, societal, or personal. The point is to show how this case has affected your detective. They're now doing things they've never done before, going to places they've never gone before, all in the pursuit of this secret. But ultimately, it's almost always that dark turn that leads the hero to the theme that will transform them. And it's what makes the novel worth reading. Another popular, although not required, element found in many a whodunit is the case within a case. The detective will sometimes start out investigating one mystery, only to find it intricately linked to another, often a case that was just ending at the start of the novel. We see this prominently in the Woods by Tana French. The novel starts out in 1984 in a small Irish town. Three kids go out to play in the woods. Only one comes back, Rob Ryan, who later becomes a detective sent to investigate the disappearance of a young girl in the same town. It's no surprise that as author French turns over the cards, the cases start to blend together, and our detective's involvement in the old case starts to blur his view of the new case. Even if the old case is never solved, as in the Woods, it's usually this case within the case that reveals the story's theme and teaches the detective some type of lesson about themselves. In the end, the detective, the secret, and the dark turn all serve one inherent purpose: to show us something about the dark side of human nature. We leave novels like Memory Man, In the Woods, and Then There Were None, and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, feeling satisfied that we've solved the mystery and that the hero has been transformed by it, but also feeling just the slightest bit uneasy. Yet it's this very unease, this little nugget of truth about ourselves, that keeps us reading and that has made the whodunit genre one of the most classic and widely read story genres. To recap, if you're thinking of writing a whodunit novel, make sure your story includes these three essential ingredients. A detective, whether that's a professional, an amateur, or even the reader. It just needs to be someone with a case on their hands, a case that they are not fully prepared for, whether they realize it or not. A secret, the key to unraveling the whole thing. What is inside the last darkest room of our hunt for the truth? It should illuminate something about the dark side of humanity, something we didn't think was possible before the case began. A dark turn, the moment when the hero or detective finds themselves so deep into the mystery that their own rules, morals, and/or ethics are compromised. The hero must do something, usually in the second half of the novel, that somehow breaks the rules or threatens their integrity or even their innocence. These are the harrowing stakes of a good mystery, and the dark turn is why readers care about this particular case. Because the pull of this secret has become so strong, even the straightest arrows are helpless against it. Popular whodunit novels through time include The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, A is for Alibi by Sue Grafton, Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. For a complete list, please refer to the bonus PDF that came with this audiobook. Here is the beat sheet for The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. Save the cat genre, why done it? Book genre, mystery thriller. Total pages, 323. Riverhead Books paperback edition, 2016. This instant blockbuster by Paula Hawkins debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list and went on to become a hit movie starring Emily Blunt. The Girl on the Train successfully uses a popular mystery novel device, the unreliable narrator, to pull you into the story and leave you guessing until the very end. But like so many great mystery novels, the most compelling question of the story is not who killed Megan Hipwell, but why. And that's what makes this page-turner such a fantastic example of a successful whodunit novel. 1. Opening image, pages 1 to 2. This book opens up, not surprisingly, on a train. It's a fitting opening image, as so much of this book will take place on a train. We meet Rachel, aka the girl on the train, one of three female protagonists, and our primary hero of the book. We soon learn that Rachel is obsessed with other people's lives, a flaw introduced on the second page that will drive the entire story. 2. Theme stated, page 1. On page 1, Rachel says, "My mother used to tell me that I had an overactive imagination. Tom said that too." The book's theme is reality, how easily it can be manipulated, and how the three protagonists, Rachel, Megan, and Anna, refuse to accept it. It's not until Rachel learns the theme of accepting reality and comes face to face with the biggest truth of them all that she finally solves the A story mystery, as well as the B story internal mystery of her own life. 3. Setup, pages 2 through 38. Rachel's status quo world is bleak. In the first 12% of the novel, Paula Hawkins effectively introduces Rachel's things that need fixing. Rachel is an alcoholic who drinks and blacks out way too much. Rachel lives in a fantasy world, making up stories about the wonderful life of a couple she's named Jess and Jason, who live at 15 Blenheim Road in Whitney. Rachel can't get over her ex-husband Tom, who happens to live three doors down from Jess and Jason with his new wife Anna, whom he had an affair with while still married to Rachel. Rachel has frequent blackouts in which she calls Tom, sometimes even stopping by his house, and he and his new wife are getting sick of it. Rachel's roommate is losing patience with her and her drinking. Rachel has already lost her job because of her drinking and rides the train every day only to avoid telling her roommate. Also in the setup is where we first meet our second protagonist, Megan, eventually revealed to be Jess. Megan's chapters are all told in flashback, starting a year earlier and steadily leading up to the present. Here, in only a few short pages, we learn that Megan's life is nothing like the fantasy Rachel has conjured up for her. She's restless and deeply troubled. We will soon learn by what. She's seeing a therapist, and her marriage is not perfect. In the first Megan chapter, we're introduced to the mysterious him, a character who will continue to play a role in the story, and whose identity will keep us guessing. Here is where Paula Hawkins first starts to use her great powers of misdirection to keep us in suspense and show us that in this world, nothing is what it seems. 4. Catalyst, pages 38 to 41. Although there's a smaller inciting incident on page 29, when Rachel sees Jess, Megan, kissing another man, effectively shattering her idealized view of her favorite couple, the real catalyst of this story comes when Rachel wakes up on a Sunday morning, after blacking out from drinking, to find a lump on her head, blood in her hair, bruises on her legs, and vague memories of going to Blenheim Road the night before. Now the real fun of the girl on the train begins. Did she go there to pay her ex-husband and his new wife another drunken visit? Or did she go there because earlier, when she saw Jess kissing another man, she swore, "If I saw that woman now, if I saw Jess, I would spit in her face. I would scratch her eyes out." Page 31. Rachel also vaguely remembers a red-haired man with her on the train. He will prove important, but for now, he's just another detail lost in the black void of her memory, along with, well, everything else that will make up the pages of this masterfully plotted thriller. 5. Debate, pages 41 through 62. The big debate question of this novel is, what happened on Saturday night, and what will Rachel ultimately do about it? Rachel can't shake the feeling that something bad happened that night, and that she's somehow responsible. Meanwhile, in a stasis equals death moment on page 41, Rachel's roommate, fed up with her drinking, threatens to kick her out of the apartment. Rachel continues to try to piece together what happened, but it isn't until Rachel learns that Megan went missing on Saturday night that she finally gets her act together and decides to do something about it. This second catalyst, called a double bump in Save the Cat terms, is what will push Rachel into Act Two. Meanwhile, in more flashbacks, we learn that Megan was having an affair with the mysterious him, which Hawkins's clever sentence structuring leads us to believe is Megan's therapist, Kamal Abdik. We also start to suspect that Megan's husband Scott, Jason, might be responsible for her disappearance, thanks to subtle little hints like, "We got into a fight, one of the bruising ones." Is Scott capable of hurting his wife? 6. Break into Two, pages 62 through 64. Rachel leaves her status quo Act One world behind when she decides to take action and try to solve the mystery of Megan's disappearance, or more important, the mystery of her possible involvement in Megan's disappearance. 7. B story, page 89. Rachel's B story, internal story, relates to her past. She must face up to it before she can truly break through these mysteries of the present. And that internal story is represented by twin B story characters in this book. Scott Hipwell, Megan's husband, whom Rachel befriends and bonds with after Megan's disappearance. And Anna Watson, Tom's new wife, the source of Rachel's painful past. On page 89, Rachel visits Scott Hipwell to tell him about the man she saw kissing Megan before she disappeared. Scott will eventually help Rachel learn the theme by turning out not to be the man she thought he was, fantasy versus reality. Then on page 108, we read our first chapter from Anna's perspective and get a glimpse of the other side of the story. This novel is all about that other side of the story. What aren't we seeing? What don't we know? What is our unreliable narrator unwilling or unable to tell us? 8. Fun and Games, pages 64 to 136. The upside-down version of Rachel's life is illustrated through her involvement in investigating Megan's disappearance. She researches at the library, comes up with theories, visits Whitney, where her hazy memories of Saturday night take place, meets with Scott, B story, and tells the police about seeing Megan kissing another man, who turns out to be Megan's therapist, Kamal Abdik. Meanwhile, she stops drinking. She's feeling and looking better than she's ever felt before. I am interested for the first time in ages in something other than my own misery. I have purpose, or at least I have a distraction. Page 85. Rachel is clearly on an upward path. But as she points out in her own narrative, it's just a distraction. Has she successfully dealt with the source of her drinking, her painful past? No. She's just found a replacement for it. A new way to numb the pain. She's fixing things the wrong way, as so many heroes do in Act Two. And it's working. The case seems to be making progress, thanks to her tip about Kamal Abdik. But until she actually faces her reality, theme, she won't be able to truly solve the mystery, both Megan's and her own. Paula Hawkins does an excellent job of putting readers in the same boat as Rachel, believing what we see, and trusting our own minds. By the time we reach the midpoint, we've come to the same conclusion as Rachel. Kamal Abdik is behind Megan's disappearance. He was almost definitely the one she was having an affair with. 9. Midpoint, pages 137 to 161. Victory! Kamal Abdik is arrested and evidence is found in his home and his car. It seems the police, thanks to Rachel's help, are getting closer to the truth about what happened to Megan. A and B stories cross as Rachel is leaving Scott's house after finding out about Kamal, A story, and running smack into her past, Tom and Anna, B story. This time, however, Rachel reacts differently. She's indifferent to them, or so she tells herself, because she's still on the high of her false victory. But like so many false victory midpoints, something bigger is coming. A tiny bomb is waiting to explode and send the story and us in a new direction. And as is so often the case in whodunits, by the midpoint, we think we know what this case is about. We may even think we know who done it, but we don't. A midpoint twist will prove that it's much bigger than we thought. And that's exactly what happens in this novel. Soon, the stakes are raised when Kamal is released without being charged, and Megan's body is found buried in the woods. This is no longer a disappearance. This is a murder. And our prime suspect just got away. 10. Bad guys close in. Pages 161 to 244. Rachel has already started drinking again. A lot. Which proves that her fun and games change wasn't a real change. It was just a band-aid. Her internal bad guys are still in there. And now they're about to come out in full force and drive her toward the All Is Lost, which is evident in the fact that she still won't talk to the red-haired man from the train. She knows he knows something about that fateful Saturday night, yet she's still too afraid of the truth. Theme. Meanwhile, however, in the Megan flashbacks, Megan's life is improving. She's opened up to Kamal about the tragedy of her past, accidentally killing her own baby in the bathtub, and is starting to feel lighter and less burdened. In the present, more details about Megan's death surface. She died of a head trauma, and she was pregnant. Scott becomes a prime suspect in the case, yet Rachel gets closer and closer to him, eventually even sleeping with him, proving that she still hasn't learned the theme. "I wanted it," Rachel tells us. "I wanted to be with Jason," page 217. Jason doesn't exist. He's a character in her dream world. Rachel goes to see Megan's therapist, Kamal Abdik, posing as a new patient. At first, she's pursuing her misguided goals of wanting to get involved in the case and to feel needed. But then, in a shift from wants to needs, Rachel finds the sessions helpful in confronting her past with Tom and her drinking. More memories start to surface for Rachel. She now remembers someone hitting her and walking away. She thinks it might have been Anna. Meanwhile, from Anna's point of view, we learn things are going downhill for her too. Rachel is driving a wedge between Anna and Tom. They fight a lot, and Anna starts to suspect that Tom might be having an affair, again. She hits an all-time low when she essentially becomes Rachel, drinking heavily and snooping through Tom's stuff. 11. All is Lost, pages 244 to 252. The case and Rachel's internal story both hit rock bottom when Scott invites Rachel over to tell her that the baby wasn't his, or Kamal's, which means there's another guy. This turning point reveals to both Rachel and us readers that things were never what they seemed. The him Megan kept referring to was not Kamal. It was someone else. But who? Scott is drunk and irate when he delivers this news. He's also found out that Rachel lied to him about a lot of things. And when he finds out that Rachel was seeing Kamal as a patient, he thinks she's been out to get him from the start. He attacks her, grabbing her by the hair and locking her in a spare bedroom. Then he threatens to kill her, whiff of death. Rachel is more certain than ever that Scott killed Megan. Now all is lost for Rachel. And it was her lying and meddling that brought her there. But not facing up to the truth, Rachel's theme, also played a huge part in bringing her to this low moment. Because if she had confronted her past earlier, she might have realized who the real bad guy is in this story. 12. Dark Night of the Soul. Pages 252 to 269. Scott lets Rachel go, and she drinks herself into a stupor. She tries calling the police to tell them that Scott threatened her and definitely killed his wife, but they don't believe her. As a drunk rubbernecker, she's lost all credibility. And then Rachel does what many heroes do during the dark night of the soul. She gives up. All this time, I've been thinking that there was something to remember, something I was missing, but there isn't. Page 254. Rachel tried to get involved, thinking she was helping, but that wasn't the answer. The answer has been inside her this whole time, locked inside the black box of her memory, inside her own past. Only when Rachel finally confronts the red-haired man and asks him about Saturday night does she start heading toward a real solution. The red-haired man tells Rachel that when he saw her on Saturday night, she was upset. There was a man walking away from her, and he was with someone, a woman. Rachel assumes this must have been Tom and Anna, but when she asks Tom about it, the stories don't match up. Tom tells her Anna was at home with the baby. So who was with Tom? Then Tom says something that triggers her memory. "I'm surprised you remember anything at all, Rachel. You were blind drunk." Page 261. Rachel remembers Tom saying this to her another time she blacked out from too much alcohol, and then he claimed she did something horrible. Things start to become clear for Rachel when she realizes Tom was the one who hit her on Saturday night. Dark night epiphany. Meanwhile, Anna is having a dark night of the soul of her own. As she drinks and snoops through Tom's things, she finds a cell phone hidden in his gym bag. It belongs to Megan Hipwell. 13. Break into 3. Page 271. Memories fill Rachel's head as she realizes the truth about Tom. He's been lying to her and manipulating her for a long time. Rachel learns the theme and confronts the past, leading her to take action and, appropriately, get on a train. Headed where? We will soon find out. 14. Finale. Pages 271 to 318. Point 1. Gathering the team. Rachel goes to Tom and Anna's house to collect Anna. She can't do this alone. They, the two wives of the lying, murdering Tom Watson, need to do this together, as a team. Point 2. Executing the plan. Rachel tries to convince Anna to come with her, but Anna doesn't believe that Tom is a murderer. She just thinks Tom had an affair with Megan. Anna hasn't learned the theme yet. She's still living in her own fantasy world, afraid to accept the truth. Point 3. High Tower Surprise. Tom comes home, and things get messy. Rachel is there and confronts Tom, and he, of course, lies to get out of it. It's a battle for Anna's loyalty, and Tom is winning. Rachel tries to convince Anna to call the police, but she won't. Tom reveals the truth about killing Megan. Rachel tries to run, but Tom hits her on the head with a bottle, and she passes out. Point 4. Dig deep down. Both Rachel and Anna prove that they've learned the theme and that they have what it takes to win this. First, Anna sneaks into the hallway to phone the police. Then Rachel plays right into Tom's hand, letting him think he has the same control over her he's always had. Now she is manipulating him. Point 5. The execution of the new plan. As Rachel lets Tom kiss her, she slips her hand into a drawer in the kitchen and steals something. Then she runs. When Tom chases after her, Rachel plunges a corkscrew into his neck. The use of a corkscrew as the final weapon is not coincidental. It represents Rachel's drinking problem, her past, and now her triumph as she uses it to once and for all rid herself of her demons. 15. Final image, pages 318 to 323. In a mirror image to the opening, Rachel is on the train again. But this time things are very different. This time she's been sober for 3 weeks, and she's moving forward, leaving her old world and her past behind her. Why is this a why done it? The girl on the train contains all three elements of a successful why done it story. A detective. Our hero, Rachel, is the amateur sleuth of the story. She's never cracked a case before and is therefore wholly unprepared for what she's getting herself into. A secret. The relationship between Megan and Scott leads to the unraveling of the whole case. It's the card that author Paula Hawkins withholds until the very end, turning it over just in time for Rachel and the reader to put the final pieces together. A dark turn. When Rachel sleeps with Scott Hipwell, we know she's in too deep. Not only is she sleeping with one of the suspects, but she's sleeping with a husband whose wife has been murdered. It's the moment when her obsession with the case overpowers her ethics. If you'd like to read an abbreviated version of this beat sheet, check out the Cat's Eye View for The Girl on the Train, which can be found in the bonus PDF.